It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Years ago, Europeans were laughing at American wines. Today, they're emulating them. So what's changed in a generation? Our guest, Paul Lucas, is author of American Vintage, The Rise of American Wine. He tells about the single wine tasting that started the revolution. Jane and Michael Stern are eating cheeseburgers in paradise in Mobile, Alabama. Beer maven Stephen Beaumont dashes some myths of which beers go best with spicy foods. Food expert John Willoughby's got some ideas for grilling fruit. And then it's the muscles of summer, and we are not talking lifeguards here. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about blueberries. They're coming into season, and they're going to be with us most of the summer. Now, there are two different types of blueberries. I've tasted some good cultivated blueberries, and that's what we eat almost all the time. But during a vacation in Maine one summer, I had my first wild blueberry. They're the size of plump buckshot, really tiny, and they taste sweet, but with this tangy bite, kind of as though you put some black pepper in the sugar bowl. Our big discovery was that local women baked the wild blueberries into pies and sold them. Wild blueberry pie. It was so good, we sat on the beach and just ate it with our hands. Four people polished off an entire pie in about 10 minutes. So if you run across wild blueberries, do not pass them up. Even if you have to pick them yourself. In fact, that sounds like a lot more fun than just going to the farm stand. Okay, most of the time we're not going to find wild blueberries. So what to buy? First, seek out organic. Often the flavor's better. Now, when you look at boxes of blueberries in the stores, they all seem alike, but they're not. There's about 50 varieties of blueberries that are grown in the United States, and each one tastes different. So always sample before buying. You gotta have courage here. You gotta gently lift that cellophane cover of that little box, reach in, and very discreetly take a berry. I can hear the grocers all getting on the phone now. But guys, we're the customer. Put out samples. It'll save you a lot of problems. Okay, once you've found blueberries you like, think about freezing some for winter. It's easy. Just rinse the berries, dry them, then spread them on a cookie sheet and freeze. Once they're solid, fill up heavy freezer bags with them, press out all the air, seal it, and you're done. They'll hold nicely for about 6 months. You can make a really easy blueberry sauce. Just boil the berries with sugar to taste, add some orange zest, a pinch of salt, a cinnamon stick, and cook it until it's thick. Use this over fruit or ice cream or cake. There's a great trick when you bake with blueberries. Toss them with a little flour. That way, when you put them in a cake batter or a muffin batter, they won't all sink to the bottom. Now, personally, I think the best thing that can happen to blueberries is blueberry pie. I have never been able to get that wild blueberry pie out of my mind, so I've come up with a trick that makes cultivated berries taste a little bit wild. Use any blueberry pie recipe you like, but substitute dried blueberries for about a quarter of the berry measurement. Soak them, then mince them, then blend them in with the fresh fruit. Here's how I do it. Now, this is for a two-crusted 9-inch pie. Have the oven at about 450 degrees and set an oven rack as low as possible. When you bake a pie near the bottom of the oven, you get a crisper bottom crust. Roll out your pie pastry, line a 9-inch pan, and then roll out another big circle of dough that'll cover the pie. I usually do this about an hour ahead and chill the two pieces. For the filling, take a generous 3 cups of blueberries and then a 1/2 cup of dried blueberries. Soak those, drain them, chop them up. Toss all that fruit with the grated zest of a lemon, about a half a cup of sugar, and then a tablespoon each of cornstarch and lemon juice. I always add a generous pinch of salt and black pepper. The black pepper kind of sparks the blueberry sweetness. Fill up your pie shell, cover it with the top pastry, seal them together, and then make some cuts in the top to let the steam escape. Now set the pie on a cookie sheet and bake 20 minutes. Turn the heat down to 400 and bake another 20 to 30 minutes. The blueberries should be bubbling. Cool the pie on a rack and serve it up. So keep your eye out for wild blueberries, try a blueberry pie, and join us for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find the Bialetti Vogue cookware line from Italy, featuring Teflon platinum interiors, polished aluminum bottoms, and stainless steel handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today's show asks the question, how did a country with no major winemaking traditions become a world leader in a single generation? The country is the USA. The man with the answers is our guest, Paul Lucas. He's the author of American Vintage, The Rise of American Wine. Beer authority Steve Beaumont says it's Chao de Dos Equis. That's the Mexican beer everyone drinks with Mexican food. He's got a whole new approach to beer with spicy foods. One of our favorite grill guys, Gourmet Magazine editor John Willoughby, stops by. And there's a new mussel out there, as in shellfish. Then, as we do every week, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, come on. It's traveling time. Where are you guys roaming these days?
Well, Lynn, for us, it's always traveling time, but we have recently been to Mobile, Alabama, to a wonderful place called the Dewdrop Inn, which, amazingly enough, given its name, is not a bar, but it's a place to eat cheeseburgers and French fries and Coca-Cola.
And wonderful hot dogs.
But tell me about the cheeseburgers, because, to me, a cheeseburger may not be the most exciting thing in the world.
We do have to tell you about the cheeseburgers because, Lynn, you're probably aware that Mobile, Alabama is the home of Jimmy Buffett, who wrote Cheeseburgers in Paradise.
Oh,
and
yeah,
the rumor
right.
is that Dewdrop Inn was his inspiration. These are not grand cheeseburgers, not gourmet cheeseburgers. They're nice cheeseburgers, but what's great about them is the toppings that are available. You can get them topped with chili, mustard, ketchup, sauerkraut on a nice toasted bun piled high. It's just a grand classic American cheeseburger.
I think what I love about this place, Lynn, is the whole gestalt of the place. It's been there since 1924, and it's actually Mobile's oldest restaurant. It hasn't changed very much since the 1920s. It's got this pre-Depression era look about it, with wooden booths with partitions between it, Coca-Cola bottles with flowers put in them on the laminated tables, waitresses that call you hun and precious. I love being called precious by a waitress. And just good, really good, normal, all-American cheeseburgers eaten in a classic roadhouse in a classic southern city.
It sounds good, but I know Michael is dying to tell us about the hot dogs. So, Michael.
Oh, Lord, don't encourage him.
You've got, tell us about the hot dogs, Michael.
We hot dog people must speak up, and I am about to. I'm about to tell you about a really wonderful hot dog. Again, nothing fancy or deluxe, but what's great about the hot dogs at the Dewdrop Inn is they're steamed. They're presented in a toasted bun. You get them topped with sauerkraut, that beefy, moist chili, mustard, ketchup, and a pickle slice. Or, if you're a real connoisseur of these dogs, you get them ordered upside down, which is the dog sitting on top of the condiments. Or, if you're really weird...
What is the point of that, Michael?
Well, the condiments don't fall off. The dog keeps the condiments inside the bun. Or, if you're really odd, you ask for your hot dog shaved, which means no sauerkraut. But that's pretty weird.
Or, if you're Jane and Michael Stern and you tire of eating hot dogs and hamburgers...
Which Michael Stern will never do.
Well, if you're Jane Stern, then you also should realize that the Dewdrop Inn has a really large menu that also has po' boy sandwiches, gumbo, Gulf shrimp, and wonderful turnip greens, rice, and gravy. So it's not just a hot dog and hamburger place, but it's funky and wonderful and southern to the core.
So this is Mobile. Is Mobile a nice city?
Mobile is great. It kind of reminds me of New Orleans in that it's a Gulf city. They even have their own Mardi Gras, but it's kind of a lesser known city. It doesn't have the high profile of New Orleans, but it still shares the Gulf Coast seafood and absolutely has probably some of the best oysters that you could ever find anywhere.
And it's the only city where you can eat West Indies salad, a Mobile specialty of cool crab meat and onions that are sort of marinated.
Ooh.
It's just the best appetizer in the world.
This sounds
good.
But
the Dewdrop Inn is one of those places that you will never find tourists going to. It's really a locals-only place. And I think when Michael and I were there, we saw ladies and gentlemen, I think it was a Sunday, maybe it was after church, eating there, and I swear these people look like they had been there since 1924. I mean, just, you know, this was obviously the ritual, the weekly ritual to come and eat a hamburger and a Coca-Cola.
Cheeseburger.
Cheeseburger, excuse me, in paradise.
Okay, so we've got the Dewdrop Inn in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
And do drop in.
Cheeseburger is paradise.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to our website, that's splendidtable.org. Steve Beaumont writes about beer for national publications and is the author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. Steve's done a lot of work on beer and food pairings, and he's joined us in the studio. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thank you.
So, Stephen, let's look at the place where most people drink beer with food. And when I think of that, the first thing that comes to mind is spicy food, Mexican beer with Mexican food. Now, does that work for you?
In a word, no.
Why not?
Well, you know, it's the natural inclination of people to drink the beer of the cuisine, you know, the same nation, match your nations up. But in the case of Mexico, this is not a brewing culture that developed alongside its cuisine. And so there's no logic in matching Mexican food with Mexican beer because the two things didn't grow up beside each other. So what I like to do is I like to look at the component parts of Mexican food, you know, the spiciness, the mole sauce or whatever, mm-hmm. and match the beer that way. In the case of spice, I look for the amount of hoppiness or bitterness in a beer, which I find will soothe the spice in the food rather than trying to obliterate it through just freezing your taste buds with ice cold lager.
So give me some examples then of what we should be drinking with Mexican food.
Well, I think Pale Ale and India Pale Ale are two great beers for drinking with Mexican food. And that's because the elemental part of these two beer styles is the hop. And the hop is what gives you bitterness in beer. In matching beer to food, hops act much the way acidity does in wine. So what it does is it gives you a nice level of bitterness that kind of provides a strange kind of complementary relationship to the spice in the food. Some examples, Anchor Liberty Ale from Anchor Brewing in San Francisco, Brooklyn East India Pale Ale from New York, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale from California. These are India Pale Ales and Pale Ales that have a nice hoppy base to them and really provide a nice complement to spicy foods.
Stephen, let's go back for a minute. You said something about beer that evolved with a culture. There are places in the world where that's happened, where the beer is really right with the food, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the great brewing countries, England, Germany, the Czech Republic, and I think the best example of all, Belgium. The Belgians pretty much invented cuisine à la bière, or beer cuisine. And these are national dishes in Belgium that both incorporate beer in the cooking and also pair beautifully with beer. We're seeing a lot of Belgian restaurants open around North America nowadays, Monk's in Philadelphia, Belgo in New York. And these are places where you can go and you can have authentic Belgian cuisine and match it with authentic Belgian beer.
Well, since Belgium produces some 300 some odd different beers, can you come up with a combination you'd like us to sample, a specific one?
Well, I think a very simple and delicious Belgian dish, which is classically Flemish, is carbonade. Carbonade is really, at its essence, a beef stew with beef, onions, cooked with beer to make the broth. And always served alongside a nice plate of frites or French fries. You take that with a northern Flemish brown ale like Leefman's Gudenbond or Rodenbach Grand Cru, and just it's a wonderful pairing. It's a beautiful match. If you don't have access to Belgian beers themselves, you can look to some great local breweries that produce Belgian style beers. I think that New Belgium Brewing is widely available across the United States. They do a very nice double. Unibrew from Quebec is pretty well distributed across the U.S. right now, and they make an absolutely marvelous beer called Maudite. It's just a really nice, spicy brown ale that goes beautifully with this type of cuisine. Mm.
Stephen, thank you.
Oh, this has been a pleasure.
Steve Beaumont is author of Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, the World's Strongest, Boldest, and Most Unusual Beers. You know, there's a whole other realm here with beer. Let me give you an instance. We talked about this carbonade dish. Well, beer and fruit is this great marriage. So try this. Follow me on this one. Take some apricot jam. Trust me. Good, real robust dark beer and lots of garlic. Mix that together, use it as a marinade, and or use it as a baste. Grilling chicken. Do you know what else it's really good on? Just a little bit at the end of cooking. Grilled salmon steaks. So think about beer, fruit, and then something spicy. Garlic, something hot. Make that the marriage. Well, coming up, the American Wine Revolution. Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family. Just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. In a single generation, American wines have leapt from either being ignored by the rest of the world or being laughed at to being a major influence on the international wine market. Now, all of this has come to pass in 30 years. So why has it happened over that time? And who made it happen? Our guest is Paul Lucas. His new book looks at the key personalities who have shaped this new American revolution that's not about tea, but rather about the grape. The book is called American Vintage, The Rise of American Wines. Paul, glad to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So, Paul, where did this begin? What brought about all of this?
A lot of factors brought it about. Certainly one very important one was the improved quality of American wine and the changing image of American wine. It was only a generation ago that American wine was widely regarded as the stuff of Skid Row. Today it's widely regarded as being on a par with the world's best. So it was changing in quality, but it was also changes in perception. They went hand in hand in the 70s and 80s to create the boom in American wine.
Yeah, you know, I'm remembering, was it sometime in the mid-70s, there was this tasting in France?
It was in 1976, in Paris.
Didn't that have a lot of influence? Maybe you could tell us about that.
It was a tasting put on by an English wine merchant named Stephen Spurrier, who had a wine shop in Paris. And he was interested in what was happening in America, specifically in California. And he brought some of these wines over for French experts to taste. His idea was never to fool anybody. It was simply to show that these wines from the United States were interesting. But he did it as sort of a publicity stunt. He did it where the judges and the tasters didn't know the identity of the wines. And to everyone's surprise and to the French tasters' great chagrin, the American wines won. And it brought a lot of publicity to what was going on in Northern California and in the United States, and was a seminal moment in the rise of American wine.
Okay, so bring us up to date. Who were the people who made American wine happen between that time 25 years ago and now?
Well, certainly one of the most important and one of the most widely recognized names is Robert Mondavi. Because Robert Mondavi, starting a little before that, in fact, starting in 1966 when he started his own winery, had the then audacious vision that American wine could compete in fine restaurants and on fine wine lists and in fine shops with the best from France and the rest of Europe. But there were lots of other people who followed on smaller scales, often in what were then called boutique wineries, people like Warren Winiarski, who made the Stag's Leap Cabernet that won in Paris, and people like Mike Gergich, who made the Chateau Montalina Chardonnay that triumphed in Paris. So there were a lot of vintners and visionaries who had what was at first a rather audacious and iconoclastic idea that American wine could compete with the world's best. But over time, over 10, 20 years, this was like the snowball going downhill and just gathered momentum. And today, if we go to a fine restaurant pretty much anywhere in the United States, you're going to see more American wine competing in terms of quality and in terms of price than we've ever seen before.
How did these early winemakers deal with the fact that, I mean, this tasting in Paris aside, I remember when almost no wine shops carried any of these high-end California wines. I mean, how did they get out there with those wines?
It was difficult, and really Robert Mondavi was the one who led the way. And what he would literally do in the late 60s and early 70s is he would go to the East Coast from California, and he would carry with him bottles of fancy classified growth Bordeaux and bottles of his own Cabernet Sauvignon, and he would pour them to people with the labels covered up and say, which one do you like best? And you ought to put this wine on our wine on your wine list. And it was a hand to hand and restaurant to restaurant and retail store to retail store selling job. And he was not the only one. He was in many ways the visionary leader, but he was by far from the only one. So it was step by step and increment by increment until it gathered momentum. And when it gathered momentum, it was like the floodgates were opened.
On the other end of the spectrum, what was the story behind Gallo wines? Because that was the stuff we all drank.
And it still is the stuff that many, many of us drink. It is the Gallo Winery is the largest wine production company in the world by far. And they do a very good job in making wines in all kinds of styles and categories. But the Gallo story is really the opposite of the Mondavi story. Ernest and Giulio Gallo were two sons of Italian immigrants who went into the wine business right after Prohibition, right after some real personal tragedy in their family. And they built their company into this giant by following the classic marketing principles of give your customers what they want. The problem was that when it came to fine wine, Americans in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and to some degree still true today, aren't sure what they want because it's not something that's been a part of our culture for generations. And they would do marketing research and say, well, Americans want inexpensive wine, and Americans want fortified wine, and Americans want flavored wine, things like Boone's Apple Farm and those kinds of things. Whereas the vision of Robert Mondavi was Americans don't know what they want, and we have to go and educate them. And essentially what happened in the last 30 years is that the Mondavi vision turned out to be the right one, and the Gallos ended up following them. And today, the Gallo company, under the Gallo of Sonoma label, produces some stunningly good wines made in the classic style and following that vision of making fine wines for the American public.
Would you say, do you think there's an American taste, that there's something distinctive about our wines?
I'm not sure if there's an American taste. Nonetheless, the United States has led the way, with a lot of other countries right along there with us, in defining what I would call, and I think other wine people call, a new world style of wine, which is fruit-forward, very generous, very fleshy, not marked by sort of minerality and earthy nuances, but really emphasizing the primary taste of fruit. And nowhere in the world is this done more successfully than in California.
Mm-hmm. Very accessible wines.
Very accessible. These wines can age. These wines can be complex, but their complexity is a different kind of complexity than the classic French or Italian models.
Mm-hmm. Paul, thank you.
You're welcome.
Paul Lucas is author of American Vintage, The Rise of American Wine. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, but his first love is cooking on the grill. He's the author, along with his pal Chris Slazinger, of several books on grilling, including License to Grill. John, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn.
John, you're our grill guru. So what have you been up to lately in the backyard?
Well, actually, I've been grilling fruit.
Fruit?
Now, it used to be that people thought it was odd to grill vegetables in this country, but we're sort of used to that now. You know, everybody knows about grilled tomatoes and grilled eggplant and grilled zucchini.
Uh-huh.
But people still think it's a little odd to grill fruit, but they should get used to it because it's a great thing to do. I first thought about grilling fruit, actually, when I was a kid, oddly enough, because my mother used to do this thing where she would take peaches, cut them in half,
mm-hmm.
fill the little cavity where the pit used to be with honey, and then broil them.
Ooh,
and she,
good stuff.
They were really good. And she was, you know, a little, sometimes she forgot about them, and they got broiled till they were black on top. And that's when they were the best. So that led me to think that that's what you should do with fruit. You should put it over a pretty hot fire, medium, not really hot, but still
mm-hmm.
a pretty hot fire,
mm-hmm.
and just cook it till you get some black on it. And that only takes, with most fruits, about 2 or 3 minutes. And if you want to, and I like to do this, you can also, at the very end, the last 30 seconds or so,
yeah.
make a glaze that has some sugary component in it, some honey or some molasses or just some sugar, and brush it on there for the last 30 seconds, and it will caramelize, but you don't want it to burn, just want it to caramelize, and that adds a whole nother sweet dynamic of flavor, which really works well with fruit.
Well, I was wondering, like, can you marinate the fruit first, or is it going to kind of fall apart?
I don't really like to, because it does, you know, you want it to maintain its shape, so you don't really want to marinate it, and
right.
Also, you just oil it very lightly, you know, because you need to do that when you're on the grill, but just very lightly, because you don't want any oil dripping into the flames and causing flare-ups, because that'll give you an ashy flavor. So just a very little light vegetable oil on it before you put it on the grill.
Okay. This is really a good idea, because I'm thinking about how nicely sugar caramelizes and you get those good flavors, and that's essentially what you're doing.
Exactly. See, it works really well. And, you know, with stone fruits like peaches and plums, you just have them, take out the pit, and put them right on the grill like that.
Oh,
bananas
good.
Are great, but you cut them in half and leave them in the peel, because that way they keep their shape. Just grill them about 2 minutes with the cut side down and turn them over in about another minute with the peel side down. Pineapple is great on the grill. Thick slices. Again, you leave the rind on so that it keeps its shape. Oranges. Slice them into slices about 3/4 of an inch thick. Just mm-hmm. leave them on there for about 2 minutes. They're unbelievable.
This is good stuff. Okay. And you can eat it for dessert, but also it sounds like it'd be good to accompany meats and stuff.
Exactly. It's really great with meats as a side dish. You can make them into smoky relishes really good.
Oh, and ice cream on top of the hot fruit. Vanilla ice cream on grilled oranges and peaches. Oh, that's got to be just
that
killer.
That is the best summer dessert you can think of.
Hey, John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is co-author with Chris Slazinger of License to Grill. You can find his recipe for pork chops with grilled peaches and a molasses rum barbecue sauce. It's a mouthful. By going to our website, that's splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Joseph on the line. So, Joseph, what do you want to talk about?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank you for greatly improving the quality of my life as well as my health.
You're kidding. That's lovely.
I'm serious. I used to be one of those guys who basically looked at eating as something to do to remain conscious. And I've always been a public radio junkie, and your show kind of like fit into my schedule. I started listening to it, and your enthusiasm for food is just so infectious. Back then I would have been surprised to know that now I'm the owner of a double boiler and a confectioner's thermometer. I've out my kitchen and everything.
We're really getting to you, aren't we? This is great. Well, thank you. I'm really flattered. I really am. Well, hey, did you have a question?
Yes, one thing that's kind of left over from those old days is an addiction to pizza.
There's nothing wrong with an addiction to pizza.
Well, when I look up recipes for pizza and stuff, it usually seems like the suggestions are for just interesting toppings and so forth, but I can figure that out myself. But once I'm having trouble with the crusts I make are kind of inconsistent. Sometimes they taste too yeasty, and even when they turn out okay, they're just kind of bland. And I was wondering if you had any interesting ideas.
Oh,
for
boy,
you.
I've got, over the years you collect so many recipes for pizza dough, and essentially it's a good bread dough. I'm going to give you a basic idea, okay? What I would do is, first of all, start out with really good flour, like all-purpose, unbleached, and if you can get it organic, that would be great.
Okay.
And let's say, for argument's sake, if you have 2 cups of flour, which will make a nice-sized pizza, you want to have maybe a teaspoon or two of yeast at most. The less yeast you use and the slower you let the bread rise, the better it's going to taste.
Okay.
And you can start it the night before. So if you throw, let's say, 2 cups of flour, we'll just make up a recipe, but this is basically 2 cups of flour, about a teaspoon of salt,
okay.
And that's the other thing. You know, bread needs salt to taste. And a lot of people kind of pull back on it, or recipes don't have quite enough. And then you want about, let's say for the 2 cups, a teaspoon of yeast, dry yeast, the stuff in the envelope.
Is that more or less than a packet?
No, a packet will have close to a tablespoon. So into the packet with a teaspoon measure.
Okay.
And what you want to do is you put that in about a quarter cup of warm water, you know, just to and add a pinch of sugar to that just to see that it's alive and bubbling.
Okay. Do you have a suggestion for the temperature of the water?
No more than 110 degrees.
Okay.
So 90 to 110. And when it starts to get bubbles, a little froth on top, you know the yeast is alive and well.
All right.
So do you have a food processor?
Yeah.
You can make this all in the food processor. Throw the flour in the food processor, the salt in the food processor, the yeast with a quarter of a cup of water, and add about another half cup of cold water.
Okay.
Turn on the food processor, and what you want to end up with is a dough that's soft and a little bit sticky.
All right.
You may need to add a tad more water. It may be too dry. Run the food processor, count to 5, and you're there. Then stick it in the fridge overnight. And the next morning...
Do I need to cover it when it's in there?
Yeah, cover it. The next morning, take it out of the fridge and leave it sitting on the counter until you want to make your pizza. And it may be even that night.
All right.
Nothing's going to go wrong with this. And then roll it out as thin as you can get it and get your oven as hot as the devil, the highest you can get your oven. And you can use stones to cook on at the bottom of the oven, or, you know, a pizza stone or tiles, or you can do what I do. I just use a big pizza pan. And what I do is I cook the pizza at like 500 degrees for maybe 8 or 9 minutes. I pull it out and I lift it off the pan. You just use a long spatula and I slip it right onto the oven rack and that crisps it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's neat. So if you don't have, you know, a pizza stone or any of that stuff, this makes up the difference. And it's a fast thing. It's really fast. And you can put whatever topping you want on it.
Okay, so I don't, like, pre-cook the crust?
No.
Putting the topping on?
Everything goes on at the same time, but the crust is rolled real thin. You may want to give it a 10-minute rest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then you just put the topping on, and you get it into that oven. But that oven's got to be as hot as the blazes.
Okay.
You're on.
All right.
Okay.
I'm gonna start that right now.
All right. Hey, thanks for the kind words, too.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Enjoy.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Do you know how empowering it is to hear this kind of thing from somebody who's really learned to have a good time with food? This is great. I wonder if he's married. But I digress. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, let's see. Who have we got on the phone? It's Janet. So, Janet, what do you want to talk about?
I was coming across a catering menu, and it said, had arancini, and I looked it on the internet, and it said rice balls, but didn't give much more detail.
Oh, you mean arancini, beginning with an A. It's
yeah.
Okay. It's not easy to pronounce. And you want to know what they are?
And is it something I can make, or do I go buy it? All of the above.
Oh, you have hit a nerve, Janet. Okay, let me explain what it means. Arancini is Italian. It's from Sicily, and it means little oranges.
Sure.
Now, let me tell you what these are. This is maybe some of the best street food / snack food could lay your hands on. By the way, where do you live? Because I may be...
Dearborn, Michigan.
Okay, you may not have a great Italian, big Italian neighborhood.
I don't think so.
In parts of the country where there's a big Italian neighborhood, you can often find these in Italian groceries. And This is what they are, okay? The Sicilians do these because, you know, Sicily has a ton of oranges. They flourish there. So that's why they call them little oranges. You have rice, medium grain rice, you cook it. While it's still hot, you mix it with sheep's cheese, pecorino, saffron that you've diluted in a little water, okay, and salt and pepper and some eggs to hold it together. And then what you're going to do is make a ball with a stuffing in the middle of it. And it's the size of a little orange.
Oh.
And the stuffing, and this is where the fun comes in. Now, of course, it's orange, so it looks like an orange. The stuffing can be things like a meat ragu that they put in the center, so it's little chunks of meat in a luscious tomato sauce. And then you have cubes of cheese that when they get hot, they start to melt. You can have bits of onion. You can have all kinds of vegetables in there, but always with this lovely sauce. So you close up the little ball, nobody knows what's in the middle, and you dip it in egg and breadcrumb, and you fry it.
Oh, wow. Sounds yummy.
Oh, you've got me hungry. All right. Hey, thanks for the call.
Great, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, today's trivia question comes from our interview earlier in the show on the rise of American wines. Our guest, Paul Lucas, told the story of this revolutionary wine tasting that took place in Paris in the 1970s. What happened was there was a blind tasting of both American and French wines, and two American wines won. Which wines were they? Well, we'll be back in a moment with that answer, with the muscles of summer and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question goes back to our interview with Paul Lucas about the rise of American wines and the revolutionary wine tasting in the 1970s in Paris. That was won by two American wines. The question was, which two wines won? And the answer is a 1973 Chateau Montelena Chardonnay and a 1973 Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon. And they blew the French away. Nobody could believe it. Now, both these wines were from the Napa Valley. Both are still in production, and both are still considered premium winemakers. Chateau Montelena has changed ownership. Stag's Leap is still into the same direction. And I've got to add that Chateau Montelena had a 1974 Zinfandel that was just killer. And you know what? It's still drinking beautifully. Okay, that's the answer. Let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who has been waiting patiently. It's Natalie. Natalie, welcome.
Hello, Lynn. I love your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear.
I have heard a lot about white asparagus.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in cans, but never purchased it. But I did find some live white asparagus in the supermarket here some time ago.
Where do you live?
I live in Tucson, Arizona, in the middle of the desert.
Of course, a very logical place to find white asparagus in the supermarket.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I had understood that the white asparagus was much more delicate than the green. So I purchased it, and I did some experimental steaming of it, and it had no taste. It had no consistency over and above looking like a stick. Now, what did I do wrong?
I don't think it wasn't you. You know, I think we all carry this guilt. You know, whenever anything doesn't work, it's got to be me. And it is not you. I think it's your asparagus. First of all, do you know where it came from offhand?
I'm the vaguest idea.
Okay. I have a feeling it was old asparagus. That's number one.
Okay.
White asparagus is interesting because it is usually very thick stalks.
Yes.
And the way, my understanding, I'm not a gardener, but I understand that the way the asparagus becomes white is that it is either earth or something banked around it so it's not exposed to sunlight. And it's a great delicacy in places like Belgium and Germany and parts of France and Holland.
Okay.
When I lived in a world where it was pretty common, quite frankly, I agree with you. I find it to be so delicate it gets dull. But I think what you experienced was either old asparagus, asparagus that had been shipped too far,
okay,
because it's thick and it's very succulent. It takes a long time to cook, and it's not something you serve tender crisp.
Okay.
It's something you serve done, but not mushed.
Okay.
And it can be really delicate, and it's traditionally served with, you know, butter sauces, things like, imagine, okay, butter and tarragon. You know, very subtle, lovely. Okay. So I think it's the asparagus. And as far as the canned ones go, there's one word to describe them. Fe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, don't go there, because they're slimy and not good ice.
Thank you for your time and your attention and the fact that it wasn't me.
It wasn't
okay.
You. Yeah, and it usually isn't us.
Okay.
I can't believe that all the time, but I try.
Hey,
Natalie, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your show.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment or share an observation, you can call us at 800-537-5252. We have Anda on the line. Anda, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm very nervous, so please forgive me.
Anda, there's nothing to be nervous about. There's only about 800,000 people,
right,
yeah, listening to every breath you're taking. But other than that, nothing to be concerned about.
You're so kind. Anyway,
Thank you. I have
a grape arbor in my backyard. A dream, you know.
Ooh, it sounds wonderful.
And then one day I had one of these cartoon light bulb ideas. You know, I said, grape leaves, stuffed grape leaves.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did exactly what I would do with cabbage leaves. I, did a little bit of blanching, and
right,
they would soften. I did everything right,
uh-huh,
and they tasted like a straw shoe sole.
Oh, because you know what I'm thinking is you're so lucky, because what I do is I go out at night and I steal the grape leaves.
You can come here anytime.
Where are you?
I'm in Washougal, Washington.
Oh, I'd like to come to Washougal, Washington, just on general principle, never mind to steal your grape leaves.
Well, I'm a block from the Columbia River. It's just I'm serious. Do
and
come
the
out
salmon.
Here. My guest room will be ready in a couple of months.
This is wonderful. I picture the salmon are leaping as we speak. But now here's the thing. You did drop the fresh grape leaves in boiling water for a minute,
yes,
or two,
mm-hmm,
and they were still tough?
They were very, very tough.
Oh.
I mean, they were really awful. And luckily, I had tested this before taking it to a potluck or something.
Yeah, yeah. Because the thing is that normally what you do with the things is you remove the heavy veins.
Uh-huh.
And you use younger, more tender leaves. You use the generally.
No, I think
those...
I may have used the large ones.
Ah, there's
because,
the key.
You know, there's
the key.
To wrap.
Well, yeah, but and I'm not saying super tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Try that, and you know, you take the stem off, and you take off any really heavy veining, mm-hmm, which is right above where the stem,
yeah,
meets the leaf, and then I'd say drop it boiling salted water 1 to 2 minutes.
Oh, 1 to 2 minutes.
Yeah, and then what you do is just drain them on paper towel and wrap. And that, I mean, I've, as a thief of leaves, I've done it with a lot of different leaves, and it usually works pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Now, in desperation, they do come in jars. I know that seems like a waste since you've got them growing.
I can't imagine doing that.
Yes, I know, I know. You've got this great,
What if I pickled them? I mean, could I keep them for, that was my other question, you know, whether or not I can keep them longer.
Sure.
Like preserve them in some way.
Well, one thing is they're blanched and they're often put under brine, a saltwater brine. But the other, gosh, in another life, and this is so long ago, my memory's blurry. I think I remember blanching them, drying them completely, and then laying them like on, you know, saran wrap, you know, the,
yep,
plastic, something to separate them, and freezing them.
You know, I tried that too, and that didn't work either. But I didn't put them in brine. That's the thing.
Yeah, but you can put them in brine, and you can just, you know, put them in a sterilized jar, keep them in the fridge. You'll keep a couple of months.
Oh.
As long as there's a lot of salt in that brine.
Really? Just plain old salt water?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it should work.
I'm going to try it.
Yeah, because that's how they do it in the jars, you know, in the Greek.
Is that what it is? You see, I thought there was some great secret to this.
I don't think so. I think it's a fair amount of salt water, and you boil them. You know, first you blanch them, and then you stick them in that salt. You cool them down, stick them in lots of salt water, and a fair amount of salt, though. And then you just keep them.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome, ma'am. And I'll think of you sitting under your grape arbor, just plucking
right.
up with and your fingers. Your, yes, and you know, plucking up your stuffed grape leaves.
Yes.
Hey, Anda, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
No kidding, guys. I mean, I don't want to encourage this, but yes, I do. There are a lot of wild grape leaves out there. If you look in any sort of, you know, woods in your neighborhood, you're going to find wild grape leaves. And all you have to do, drop them in the boiling water, pick the younger ones, the tenderer ones, and then you can put all kinds of fillings in them. Traditional Greek fillings are things like sautéed lamb with garlic and onion and dill and some cooked rice. Or you can do a vegetarian version of it. And then you just sort of broil them or steam them. Oh, they're so good. They're so good. It's the season. Okay, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's been waiting patiently? Oh, we got Bob on the line. So, Bob, do you have some pressing, urgent thing that you want to discuss?
Lynn, you got us a food. How are you?
I am just swell. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, about two years ago, I bought a jar of juniper berries, right? You know, which were horribly expensive because I love making German food.
Uh-huh,
and
yeah.
I used them once, and I put them back in the cupboard.
Right.
And there was nothing, you know, I didn't see anything about refrigerating them or anything on the jar.
Uh-huh.
But I come back, maybe about a month later, because I'm making another German dish, and I open them, and they're all moldy.
Oh!
You know, yeah, and I was thoroughly nonplussed, because, I mean, I don't have to tell you, they're not cheap. They run for like $9 to $15 a bottle.
I know, the stuff is really, I mean, better you should go out and find a juniper bush, but then again, sometimes they're poisonous, so maybe you don't want to do that.
Exactly.
So they had mold on them?
Yeah, they had like you know, that fuzzy mold that things get, only like,
yeah.
it was even cute because you know how purple they are, so like the mold was blue.
Oh, how attractive.
Very attractive.
This is science experiment 101.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to toss them, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I tossed them.
Right.
I mean, luckily, I had a little pony bottle of gin,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to, like, jury rig it that way, and nobody could tell the difference.
Well, you know, this is a good point. When you don't have juniper berries, a little gin goes a long way. It goes a long way in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But especially, you know, in the food and in you. But because juniper berries are one of the things that are used to flavor the gin.
Right.
But aside from all of that, well, so you're saying, is this a normal thing to happen to a juniper berry?
Right, and how can I keep them? Because, you know, now, of course, I have another jar sitting there in the cupboard, and I'm terrified to open it.
Well, I have to tell you, I wonder if this is a place where we have to look at brand names, because I've had juniper berries for years,
mm-hmm.
which is not necessarily a good idea. They do lose pungency. And never had this happen. And I'm usually buying, you know, it's like McCormick's or Schilling's or, you know, one of the established brands. And maybe one of the keys is stick with those, because they probably do some sort of sterilizing process
mm-hmm.
with the berries so that you don't have this problem. But what I'm glad is you toss them, because there are still people out there who think, gee, a little mold never hurt anybody unless you know. Yeah, I know. Scary stuff, since you don't know what the mold's about. I would say buy the brand name.
Okay.
And in the case of the ones that you have, what I do, are they the same brand?
I don't think so. No.
You know, just to be on the safe side, because you don't know what spores are sitting on them, open them up and let them, you know, do the same thing you did and wait and then see if anything develops. If nothing develops, use them.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Hey, listen, you have to come to Pittsburgh. You know, this is a great food town.
I keep hearing that. And also, I want to get, you know, to the Carnegie Institute, too.
Oh, you better believe it.
All right. Hey.
And the Strip District. You'd love the Strip District.
It sounds very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, the Sterns tell us a lot about Pittsburgh.
Well,
you know,
they're right.
When they let me out of here.
Okay.
When they let me out of here, you know, you're on. I will try to do this. But thanks.
Okay.
Goodbye.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You know how I'm always going on about food in season? Well, I'm in a conflict here, because one of the great things for summer is steamed mussels, the shellfish. But unfortunately, mussels really generally aren't in their prime in the summer. I just heard about a new mussel that's available to us, and the person that was telling me about it is seafood expert John Rowley. Now, John is based in Seattle. This is the guy, by the way, who brought the world the Copper River salmon. We got John on the phone. John Rowley, good to talk to you.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, John, what is the deal? What is this new mussel?
Oh, well, it's not exactly a new mussel, Lynn. This is the mussel that is native to the Mediterranean, Mytilus galloprovincialis.
I knew it well.
Mussel of Gaul.
Mussel of Gaul. Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
This mussel has been discovered growing on the West Coast in a few locations off the California coast, and then up here in Puget Sound.
So how does a mussel get from the Mediterranean to the West Coast, the Pacific Ocean?
Nobody knows.
They traveled very, very long, hard.
It might have happened as long ago as the Spanish explorers, you know, hitchhiking on the hulls of the boats. Nobody knows.
Huh. Now, is this mussel in good shape in the summer?
This is the mussel of summer. Galloprovincialis spawns in the winter, and its meats sit there in the shell like shriveled up raisins until the water warms up and the plankton bloom, and then it plumps up and stores a lot of glycogen, and it happens very fast when it happens, and in Puget Sound it's happening right now, just in a matter of a couple of weeks. These mussels go from being not interesting at all to being just sweet and tender and delicious. So it's they're at their best right through the heat of the summer, just the opposite seasonality of the northern mussels.
So the mussels that we eat in the winter are just a completely different type of mussel, and they're not in their prime now.
Yes, a completely different mussel.
Uh-huh. What do they taste like?
Well, first of all, they're sweet. We sent some to get tested in the labs, and they have 12 to 14% carbohydrates, and I don't know of any other animal product that has that much carbohydrates to it, and it's that is mostly glycogen, which is sugars, and so they have as much sugar, although it's in a different form, as a decent peach.
This sounds great. You know, I know these mussels are farmed. Any concerns here about pollution?
Not with the mussels that go on the market. Here in the state of Washington, the Washington Department of Health does a very good job of monitoring shellfish growing waters. And then where these mussels are grown, way down in the south reaches of Puget Sound, there's no industry or anything down there. And so the waters are in good shape. And this time of year, they're just rich with plankton. You know, in the wintertime, you can look down in some of these shallow water and see the bottom, but this time of the year, it's just opaque with plankton, and the mussels are feeding very happily.
So they're getting fat and plump, and I can see them steaming in some wine and tomatoes. Hey, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, Lynn. Enjoy your summer.
Thanks.
Bye.
Well, John Rowley is a seafood expert and consultant working in Seattle, Washington. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this from the Book of Official Rules. Everything tastes more or less like chicken. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering cascade stoneware made by Anchor Hocking. This Portuguese stoneware, designed to be rugged, features an unglazed bottom for even cooking and can be used in the microwave, oven, or on the table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music was composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.